I made a pretty risky bet back in November of 2022. Now, I try not to brag, but I'm pretty good at Webflow. I'm fast, I've built a lot of websites, and back in the summer, I had already built a coming soon page for the new Dive website. But I also spend too much time on design Twitter, and I kept seeing these really compelling photos and videos of people spinning up websites in Framer. And the more that I saw, the more convinced I was that this was what the future of web design looked like. So I made a bit of a crazy bet. I decided to build the new Dive website in Framer, even though I had exactly zero experience using the tool. Well, I'm over a year in now, and I'm so grateful that I made that decision. It's such an intuitive product. The spatial canvas, the way they handle breakpoints, components. Honestly, you kind of feel like you're in Figma, only then you have that beautiful publish button up in the top right. And man, when you click it, it just feels like magic. So if you're listening to this and you're comfortable in a different tool right now, maybe it makes sense to make a bet of your own. You can head to dive.club/framer to take that next step. Now onto the episode.
When you have that prototype that maybe just entirely spaghetti code that's never actually going to ship in the background, but it creates this very high fidelity thing that's indistinguishable from production, that's like the universal language of getting feedback and just like testing your idea for real. You hand it to someone and you say, like, change the properties on this linear issue. And that is a real life user test in a way. Like, can they do it? Do they find it easy? Does it take them way too many taps to do?
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. Now, this week's episode is with Gavin Nelson, and it is a deep dive into interaction design and prototyping. We talk about his process for designing the GitHub and linear mobile apps, and he shares some really helpful snippets along his journey of learning Swift UI. But before we get into all of that, I had to learn more about how Gavin first got started designing app icons.
Like way back when, I think I started in high school, I had this moment where I realized that these icons I was seeing on my computer were handcrafted by digital artists. And I just instantly had this curiosity of, I need to know how they did that. I need to try and explore that area myself. I downloaded Photoshop, as a lot of early designers did, and started just experimenting. I remember my very first icon, I like had not learned really about vector graphics. So I looked at these beautiful like 1024 pixel icons and zoomed in real close and saw like each individual pixel, and then kind of just thought, okay, they like placed these pixels on a canvas. So I started smaller with like 64 pixels and started individually placing pixels to try and draw I think my first one was a settings icon, and quickly realized that's not how it's done. And that was a very awkward entry into trying to create a nice icon. So I followed that curiosity and kept learning more and more about vector graphics and Photoshop, trying to get a handle for the tool. And eventually started connecting more with folks online who are doing it and learning tips and tricks. And that led me into just really exploring this world of icon design and kind of sparked an interest in design as a whole. That like by the time I got to college, I was interested in exploring that. My school had a product design and kind of HCI oriented studies. So that's what I pursued. And one thing led to another, and I continued working on icon design as kind of a way to further my visual craft and just kind of practice that and stay curious about like what new can you do with it. And I started picking up this product design angle as like a really interesting way to stay in the design field, but also like think about how you can use it to solve bigger problems, make people's lives easier, like make my own life easier. I would like try and design little applications or like scripts to do things. And that kind of felt like an entry point into design. And one thing led to another. And now I've been working in the field for a bunch of years.
Was there a moment where you kind of realized, okay, this isn't just something fun, but actually I can make a career as a freelance icon designer, and this is actually something that people will pay for?
I think this might be kind of unique, but like I've tried to never really think of it as like I need to do this for a career. The way I approach it is always like doing it for curiosity or for fun or like engagement with the craft. And I've been lucky enough that doing that and sharing the results has led to enough freelance clients that it kind of naturally formed this network of folks who know me for icon design. So I've been lucky that it kind of grew organically like that. I think like if I had to focus on it as solely my job, I would get really burned out on designing icons all day, every day for way too quickly. So it's been nice to have as like kind of a little break here and there, a way to flex different creative muscles to kind of test the limits of like what you can do. And it's really a big experiment and you're constantly kind of trying new things and doing lots of iteration. And in a way, like a lot of those skills have transferred into product design, which is a nice little boost to like my learning and understanding as a designer.
Can you talk a little bit more about which skills have transferred and how basically like what elements of the visual craft that you're learning in icon design and just kind of experimenting on the fringes actually show up in the way that you practice product design?
I think the main area is just like constant iteration and constant like asking, how can this be a little bit better? If I tweak this one thing, does it get better? Does it get worse? If you look at a lot of my design files, I'm a serial duplicator of a frame or an artboard and just like make one little change, evaluate it against the previous one, duplicate the better one, make another change. It kind of turns into this mess and I spend some time at the end cleaning it all up. But it's really like a experimentation process. What do I change here that makes it better? And what do I change over there that makes it better? And just constantly trying to find the next best step. And then the other tricky part is kind of knowing when to stop. But that's something I'm always still trying to figure out.
Let's talk about the product design part a little bit. And specifically, I want to talk about mobile design because this is now your third mobile app in a row. You did Fitbod, GitHub, now Linear. And like as you put in more of these reps and you're exposed to different problem spaces and environments, what are you learning about the different techniques or strategies that make someone a good mobile app designer?
A lot of it is getting in the right mindset for solving problems on mobile. You know, there's like, it's easy to approach a problem and say like, okay, well, I can do this and put this menu here. And then you select that option. And then like three or four taps later, and you've got your solution to what the job you're trying to solve for is on a mobile phone. But when you put it into practice, you realize like people are, it really depends on the context, but kind of painting generally, people are using their phones in little 1 to 2 minute bursts here and there. And any introduction of friction or like a lot of repetitive action on a phone feels really amplified when you're trying to use it with your thumb, maybe like one-handed while you're walking the dog or something like that. And really getting into that mindset of trying to make very frictionless experiences designed for small chunks of interaction, I think makes a big difference. And it's easy to sometimes overlook and think my user has a very complicated job and I've got this very long set of steps that's going to help them solve that job on their mobile app. And really trying to distill that down to get more creative. Can we start with some very intelligent defaults? And these are all kind of principles that I think are not exclusive to mobile design, but really trying to put yourself in the mindset of the context in which your users might be experiencing what you design, I think makes a big difference.
It's been almost 5 years since I've led a mobile app design project. And I think in some ways the cost of that has been, I focus less on interaction design. There are less opportunities to really push the envelope in terms of what interaction design can look like, because in many ways, mobile, you know, the sky's the limit. So can you talk a little bit more about how you approach that part of your craft specifically?
Yeah, I think that's a really unique space in mobile design, specifically, I guess, more generally touch-based design, you know, maybe on an iPad, it would be similar, but like you have this entirely different input method from a mouse and keyboard, right? You don't have things like hover states, but you do have things like multi-touch gestures on iOS, for example. And that's really powerful. And I think it applies a unique set of constraints, but it also like opens up a whole new world of possibilities. And that's where a lot of I find nice interaction design to come in on mobile. It kind of all builds off of very like foundational principles of system feedback. Like if I touch on something, what happens? And I think Apple and iOS really pioneered a feeling of physics-based interactions. So if I push down on something, does it respond to that push? Because that is much more of a something you would expect to happen if you touch something with your finger versus like when you're using a mouse, you're very used to this digital connection. You know, there's not a lot of physical connection to what you're seeing on the screen. So taking all those little details into account, it's almost like a more well-crafted experience that by doing that just blends into the background. A great example is inertial scrolling on iOS. It's something that, for context, when you are scrolling a long list and you hit the bottom, it kind of hits the bottom and smoothly over scrolls a little bit and then like gently comes back to rest, right? And it's as if you like scrolled into a rubber band. And that's something that I think your average user doesn't immediately recognize and say, oh, that's nice when they scroll to the end of a list on iOS. But if you remove that, it starts feeling really weird. Like you're scrolling this list, you get a lot of velocity in your scrolling, a lot of momentum, and then it just abruptly stops. And that's something that you would find in a lot of digital experiences, but doesn't really map to the physical world. And I think exploring making interfaces fit in more naturally with the physical world because you're interacting with them physically with your fingers is a really unique area of mobile design and kind of interaction design on touch devices. And it's something that I'm always trying to bring into the experiences I work on. And I think like primarily through prototyping, which is another big area that I try and focus on.
I definitely want to get into prototyping. I want to go a little bit deeper on just different mobile patterns, because you've been doing this basically every day for what, like 4 or 5 years now. Talk to me a bit about what you've learned about the different mobile patterns to reach for and maybe like how that has evolved over time.
It's interesting because there's a lot of unique constraints on mobile devices. And you can think about swipe gestures as a good example, as like that's a really powerful pattern. It lets people do actions really quickly on their phone, but it's also not necessarily discoverable. And this is something that I think mobile operating systems still haven't solved for really well. And it's a really tricky problem, is like, how do I make these very powerful interaction gestures discoverable and visible to the user? And our solution right now as an industry has kind of been, let's make sure there's always a visible way to do the same action. So it might take you 3 taps to delete a notification from your inbox, which is the same as just dragging it across the screen with a swipe gesture, much faster. But if you don't know that exists, you can still complete the same action. So there's these really unique angles to a lot of problems. But what I've found again and again is you kind of have to bake in visible ways to accomplish the same goal. And I always try, like one of the things I'm always trying to do in my designs is if you are building what's essentially like a power user gesture, right? Like only a smaller percentage of your user base are going to know about it, or like very avid mobile users, to find subtle ways to hint to everyone using this app that those gestures do exist, to like onboard them into these more fast and fluid ways of interacting with their app. It's almost like a right click menu, right? You don't have a secondary input on your phone, or keyboard shortcuts. You don't have those either. And I think a lot of people use those to be far more productive. And like, that's what you want on your phone. You want to be productive and quick in your interactions. And when you can educate users about these gestures, their power kind of exponentially increases in their ability to use the app. So swipe gestures are a common one. There's a lot that are kind of interesting. Like if you imagine a modal window pops up on your phone, I want to say mobile app operating systems have kind of conditioned us to this, but it's kind of natural to think like, I want this to go away. I'm just going to flick it away with my finger, like get out of the screen here. So building a gesture into that, where when you do a flick gesture like that, it closes the modal, is a very natural extension of like what you're doing. And I think that's where a lot of the power of interaction design comes in, right? You're meeting the user with actions like based on their intent, and not requiring them to think about, okay, I want to close this. How do I do it? Let me hunt for a X icon in the corner to close it. I think it's good to still place that there. But another great example is the original, I think it's still in the system, but iOS has shake to undo. It's a little bit like annoying sometimes, it kind of gets in the way. But like when you look at the original intention, you get so frustrated with your phone and what you're doing that you just shake it like, oh, this stupid phone. And then it says, hey, do you want to undo all of this? Like, sorry, we got you into that mess. I think that's a great example, if not perfectly executed on the mobile operating systems right now.
It's cool to hear you make the connection between like a keyboard shortcut and the swipe gestures, because that does make sense intuitively to me, especially for someone that's designing for developers and power users, people who are using these tools every single day, like a GitHub, like a Linear. And I can see how that would be a big part of your practice, is trying to figure out ways to help people accomplish more quickly, but also maintaining like simplicity as the base experience.
Yeah, and there's a really interesting tension there, because it's easy to think like everyone using these more technical tools are going to be keyboard shortcut power users. And sometimes that's the case, sometimes that's not. And I think you want to solve for like everyone being able to use it, but you want to give that extra power to the people who rely on keyboard shortcuts and things like that. And the tension comes in on mobile design because like we don't have those easy shortcuts, as I mentioned, and there's not like a very obvious baked in system for like a long press to equal a right click menu is kind of the most one-to-one example. But the tension comes in where you can try and solve these things by doing some wild gestures on the screen to like do multiple actions at once and really increase someone's productivity. But users aren't necessarily going to know how to do that or like take the time to learn that, right? That's like if you went from no keyboard shortcuts to introducing keyboard shortcuts overnight and suddenly everyone's like, what are these crazy keystrokes I have to do to increase my productivity, right? On mobile, you really want to try and balance familiar patterns and think hard about how you can use these familiar patterns in unique ways to make someone more productive or to allow them to get their job done without thinking about interacting with the interface as much.
Can you talk a little bit about what you are looking for, even when just using mobile apps in your day-to-day? Like, I kind of obsess over different web experiences and I try to figure out like, okay, what are they doing? What can I draw inspiration from? How does that translate to you in just using mobile apps?
It's interesting because I think one of the things I really strive for and look for in mobile apps personally is just what I was saying earlier, like it just gets out of the way. You know, I don't have to think about interacting with it. I can just take out my phone, use app X, Y, or Z to get my job done and then put my phone away. When there's some unique pattern or something new that requires you to like learn the interface, that's almost when this friction's introduced and when like I start to get more frustrated with the app. So it's a funny balance of my goal is that the apps I'm using get out of my way. But I also, as a designer, want to acknowledge that and actually realize that, which is the opposite intention of the interface, to think like, hey, I use this 100 times a day and it's very fluid and very seamless. And I have to back up and think like, what are they doing that makes it like that? And how can I apply that to my design?
Is there an app that you've used recently where you've been impressed with some of the interaction details? Maybe you could talk a little bit about what stood out to you.
The app Things by Cultured Code. It's a to-do list app, essentially. I've been using it for years now, probably over 10 years. And it's perfectly designed in that way that I can add tasks rapidly. I can set due dates. I can like rearrange things all really without thinking about what I'm doing. And I think they just really nailed the right amount of gesture-based interaction, more power when you need it just by tapping through like easy to identify menus. Never really like gets in your way. And especially for a productivity tool, that's what I'm looking for. And like Linear is also a productivity tool, very similar, more team-based tasks and product management and like software development than just a personal to-do list, but a similar goal that I try and strive for. So I'm always trying to think what makes this fluid and seamless and what makes me love this so much. There's also just things like more entertainment apps. I recently downloaded Netflix. I've used Netflix for years, but almost always just through the website. And I downloaded the app, and the app, it feels like one of those things that has like no right to be as well-crafted as it is, but it's incredibly well done. And when you use that, it's another one of those examples where it's like, I don't have to fight this system to turn the show I want to watch on. Maybe the algorithm's like not suggesting it to you right away, but when you find the card, you can tap it, you can flick it away. When you scroll down, the header kind of shrinks very elegantly and gets out of your way a little bit, which I love. There's like a bunch of nice little interactions that I say like it has no right being as well crafted as it is. I think coming from a idea of like, it's not a productivity tool, like people just want to watch a TV show. But I think that makes a huge difference when you do put that extra energy in, because it lets users focus on the shows rather than like trying to fight against the app just to get their entertainment.
I like the Netflix example because it is like, it gets out of the way, like it checks that box, but man, there are some really delightful interactions. Like you mentioned the header collapsing when you pull down. I mean, I just studied that thing. It is so impressive. I'm like, how do you even think of this? You know, it just was so beyond my ability to conceptualize and execute against. It is really, really a nice detail.
You see that all kind of across the system. It's baked into like your standard iOS navigation bar where like you'll go from a large title. When you scroll, it shifts into the small centered title just to give you more scrolling space. And I think it gets really nice when you're using custom components like Netflix does to take a second thought of like, okay, we're going to shrink this to give people more scrolling space, but they might still want to see their filters. So how can we make these slightly smaller, but still kind of make the whole interaction invisible, but give you that extra space for when you're scrolling? And I think they did a really good job with that. Those are little details that I really think like come together to put that extra layer of polish on an app, which ideally just makes it like blend into the background more.
Can we talk about the custom components piece a little bit? Because that's a question I've seen come up a lot from people who are designing maybe for the first or second time with mobile. It's like, why do you think about when to reach for custom components versus when to rely on the system components?
Yeah, it's definitely a tricky balance. I've been in both situations where at GitHub, we built significantly more with kind of stock iOS and Material Design components. And you get a lot of advantages from that. But there's also instances where they don't quite get the job done and you need something a little bit more custom. Linear, on the other hand, kind of puts Linear's design system first to give it a big sense of brand cohesiveness and then relies on default components for both iOS and Android. I think there's like technical reasons behind all of this. You know, like Apple and Google have done excellent jobs with accessibility and they continue to improve that all the time. And a lot of that is baked into the stock components. So you know if you use the stock tab bar, it's going to meet a set level of accessibility requirements. So it definitely takes more work when you're doing it custom to meet those same requirements. And you kind of forego some advantages of like when WWDC rolls around and they release new introductions into Swift and kind of the stock set of iOS components, you don't get those immediately. You might have to do a little bit more work to integrate those APIs, but there's just trade-offs on both sides. In terms of using like mixing custom components and stock components, I think that comes in largely when you're trying to solve a problem. When I'm trying to solve a mobile design problem, I'll start by reaching for the stock components. And if something's not quite getting the job done well enough, that's when I would turn to custom stuff. Mostly for reasons like we touched on before, like you don't want to necessarily ask the user to constantly relearn how to use their phone, right? They're very used to the more default, like a bottom sheet is very ubiquitous across a lot of apps. They'll generally know how to interact with the bottom sheet. And that's something you can kind of safely introduce. But if you start getting crazier with different types of custom work, it can be very effective. Like they can pick these things up and maybe it makes them more productive, but it also can be a bit more of a learning curve and potentially turn some users away or confuse them.
Let's talk about Linear a little bit, because you actually inherited the mobile app design from Alex Cornell, who we just had on a few episodes ago. You're like a few months in. So can you talk a little bit about how that experience has been so far?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. I've loved my time joining Linear so far. It's been about 3 months. Like you mentioned, I think Alex had been there for about a year working on the mobile apps, and he really took it from basically nothing done for mobile. I don't think any code had been written, maybe a little bit, and started designing kind of the foundation. And from what I've seen of his work at Linear, he did a lot of exploration into what if we like kind of rethought or like started from nothing and thought like what is the effective uses of Linear on a mobile phone? And he arrived at a foundation that was super solid that I inherited, like you mentioned. And I got to kind of take that. And shortly after I joined, we shipped the iOS app to the first set of beta customers. So it's been really interesting hearing all of their feedback come in and try and distill that down and figure out like, what are the problems that underpin all of this feedback and how can we address that? So I've been able to take that foundation Alex left and start building on top of that and trying to change it in some ways based on feedback and based on just daily use of the app ourselves, and then expand it in other ways. But it was nice. It takes a lot of time to be confident in the foundational direction of your app. And he spent a lot of that time working on that. So I kind of got to come in at a slightly different stage and work on some different problems. But I mean, that's part of the job. I love kind of getting a mix of different problems and getting to work on different aspects of it.
Let's talk about the problem solving process a little bit then. Because a question that I really like to ask people is, what are you doing to kind of like collapse complexity and get momentum on some of these more ambiguous, meaty problems?
When you're handed a very ambiguous problem or you discover a very ambiguous problem, I think it's really important to kind of, what I do personally is just kind of like brain dump into usually like text or sketches or something, like a lay of the land. Like, what is the problem? Is that really the core problem we're trying to solve? Who is going to be using this, or who is affected by this problem, and when are they affected by it? And try and kind of paint this whole context picture. And then my goal is usually just to try and think about as many different crazy solutions as I can for the problem. And what I find is like, usually you can sketch out 100 solutions of varying degrees of like grounded in reality to the problem. And maybe like 98 of them are just totally out there. And you take those two that remain and you continue iterating on them, and you hit a little bit of a brick wall maybe at one point, and you kind of go back to those original solutions, and maybe you can take a piece of number 62 and a piece of idea number 20 and kind of combine them and apply them to the one that has been working so far and continue iterating. So it's a lot about, I mean, for one, making sure you're solving the right problem, and then two, just kind of like iterating through a lot of different potential solutions. And similar to like how I approach icon design, like making one tweak here and thinking, does this solve the problem better? One tweak here and thinking, does that solve it better? And the further you get down the line, the higher fidelity usually I go and try and move into Figma and think like, does the layout work and do the visuals work and prototyping, think, do the interactions work? Can I validate the decisions I've been making so far by trying it in a prototype? And ideally you just like slowly start chipping away at the ambiguity.
Okay, let's talk about the prototyping piece then. Can you go a little bit deeper into like, at what point will you start stringing things together into a prototype while you're still just kind of exploring this myriad of ideas?
There's two main phases where I'll do it. One is very early in the process. Like maybe I've got an idea for a interaction that isn't super common, or that like I need to test out, like, does this actually solve the problem, or is this actually like easy to use and discoverable? And at that point, I might turn to prototyping to put together a very low fidelity prototype that has kind of a higher fidelity implementation of the interaction, just to test it out and see like, okay, that doesn't work, or it needs to change in this way. Then I go back to the very early low fidelity work and kind of go from there. The other phase is much later in the process. Usually I like making prototypes to try and like validate the decisions I've been making, or really to like help make the decisions in the first place. So maybe I have a lot of the visuals looking pretty good. I've got like a solid idea for how to solve the problem I'm working on, and I'll start coding a prototype that the goal is kind of being two goals, really. One is make it as roughly as fast as I can, as fast as reasonable. And two is make it as kind of indistinguishable from what I might see in production if it was built over an engineering cycle. And the goal with that being is you can just hand that to someone and say, what do you think of this? Does it work? And that's almost, maybe there's a little context setting of like what the goal is of this, like what you're trying to get done, but you hand it to someone and you say like, change the properties on this linear issue. And that is a real life user test in a way. Like, can they do it? Do they find it easy? Does it take them way too many taps to do? When you have that prototype that may be just entirely spaghetti code that's never actually going to ship in the background, but it creates this very high fidelity thing that's indistinguishable from production, that's like the universal language of getting feedback and just like testing your idea for real. So that's why the speed part comes into it. You know, I want to get to that stage quickly, because when there are changes that need to be made, it's easy to rip out little pieces and adjust little pieces and have a version two instantly. And you don't have to spend weeks, months, however long, actually building it to then really test it with your users.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm going to use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm going to be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. I think a lot of times, maybe more so in web, but a lot of times like the interaction piece of it is kind of the thing that you figure out at the end. Once there's like full alignment on the core flow and layout and maybe even UI design. So it's interesting to hear you talk about prototyping in the early stages of your process. Can you maybe talk about that tension a little bit? Like, when is it that the interaction itself has to be the thing that you figure out, even maybe even before you nail down the specific visuals?
It might be that it's like a little bit more kind of integral to mobile design in general. But I think it really comes into play when the interaction is kind of the core solution to the problem. So for example, I've been working on a problem recently at Linear that involves kind of like a scroll view, and on top of the scroll view is a bottom sheet. And part of my idea for the solution is like you can tap in different parts of the scroll view and the bottom sheet will expand or collapse depending upon what you tap on, and you can scroll within the bottom sheet and tap on different things there, and it might move the scroll view. My sketchbook looks like the Charlie Day meme where you've just got a bunch of strings strung up and like it's completely unintelligible. And you try and put that in Figma and you've got like 40 frames to spend 20 minutes explaining to someone to like try and give them the idea. So I turned very early on in the process to code and just built a very rough prototype where when you did all those taps, like my intention for the bottom sheet would happen and you could just test it out. And it was so much faster to say, okay, this makes sense, or this one didn't make sense and I need to adjust it, than trying to like look at a bunch of Figma mockups and think like, okay, I think this is making sense. I think if you tap on this, what I would expect to happen will happen based on this spec. Where when you're holding the prototype, you tap on it and you're like, I might have spent like a week deciding, okay, this will happen and this will happen and this will happen, and then use it and you instantly know that was the right choice, that one wasn't, and that was the right choice. And then you can move on from there. So when the solution is really ingrained in the interaction, I think that's when I turn to prototyping really early to try and validate that along the way. When the interactions are kind of the level of polish at the end to try and make everything feel more fluid, that's when you can kind of start tweaking the spring values of your animation at the very final stages, or even as it's being built to production.
You've now mentioned sketching, Figma, you even said the word code a couple times. Can you talk to us a little bit about like when you reach for these different tools?
I think it really depends on the project I'm working on, but generally I'll move between the three very quickly and very interchangeably. There's not like a set, first I do this, then I do this, and then I do this. They all have their different values, and the key is that you're just using each one for what it's valuable for. So sketching might be like a lot of quick ideas. Maybe it's trying to figure out like what I need to code to make something work in a prototype, just rapidly going through things. My sketchbook is, like I mentioned, kind of unintelligible to anyone but myself. You know, it's my personal notes. It helps me record the ideas, experiment with them. When I move into Figma, it's more of an artifact that focuses on the visuals and maybe like a simple click-through prototype just to think about how things are working out, potentially to share it with others on a Zoom call type of thing. And when I move into prototyping, it's more to like really validate decisions, solidify ideas, share it with others in a way that creates an instant connection more so than giving a Figma presentation and trying to tell a big story around what I'm working on. So moving between them is pretty fluid. I might be prototyping something, decide it needs to change. The fastest way to figure out what that change is just by sketching a few solutions.
It is a theme that I'm noticing in these conversations is that the people who do have some code skills under their belt rely on sketching a little bit more, whereas the people who don't spend more time in Figma.
I try and not overthink like too much about what tool I'm using when, and just focus on what is my end goal and what's the fastest way to get there. I've seen some wild Figma prototypes that I would probably have to spend way too long messing around with all the noodles in Figma to get it to work. But there are some folks who that comes very naturally to them and they can just blast through a bunch of prototypes, and that's totally valid. You know, no hate on like any different type of tool you want to use to get to the end goal. I think it's just important to think about what your end goal is, what kind of artifact that looks like, and what an effective way to get there is.
When is code the fastest way to prototype for you?
I'm turning to it more and more, like almost exclusively now, for prototyping different things. I think where it really shines is kind of when you're trying to achieve that level of fidelity that is indistinguishable from production, right? That's very hard to do, at least for me in Figma. There's might be a lot of like smart animate little glitches, you know, like it's a crazy powerful feature, don't get me wrong, but it's not going to be quite the same as what you're doing in code or a tool like Origami. And I think that's really powerful. You know, like the higher fidelity a prototype is in some ways, the exponentially more useful it becomes. Even in the early stages, when you're trying to prototype an interaction and just quickly validate a decision, if you can get it using plain old JavaScript and HTML, just like maybe you are using Times New Roman for your text because you don't have any CSS, it can be super fast. I think folks underestimate how fast it can be to go from zero to a little working code prototype. And part of the thing is to focus on the purpose of each prototype, right? Like, you don't have to start from an idea and start coding something as if it's a fully fleshed out idea, right? You can make a little playground for yourself and code a single interaction or a single little flow and see how it works and go from there. And you can duplicate the JavaScript file and make a totally new one and try again type of thing. One of the things I've actually done at Linear is I ship a little, just internally, a little test flight app that has all of my prototypes in it. So it's a really easy way, or it's like probably the easiest way I've found to share Xcode prototypes with a team. And the very first page of the app is just an index, and it's just a list of all the different prototypes I've built. So sometimes you'll have like version one, version two. You can kind of go in and see the evolution, try different versions. That's what I turn to code for, really, and when I turn to it.
Okay, so let's say that you are coding a prototype for some project that you're working on. How often are pieces of that prototype actually making it into production? And if they're not, why reach for code versus something like an origami maybe?
I think it depends on the type of prototype it is. So that's a little bit vague, but for a better example is the Linear onboarding screen for the mobile app. You download the app, you open it up, and you immediately see this little like welcome to the app sign in basically page. And we built a little layer of delight into that where the app icon is kind of there and it's floating, appears to be floating like off the screen of the phone with a little parallax effect. So you tilt your phone one way and it kind of reacts to that. That was a prototype I created like actually before I joined Linear. I was experimenting with those effects in Swift UI. When I joined, we wanted to polish the screen up a bit and I thought this was a really unique idea. So applied it to the Linear brand essentially and experimented with it some more. In that scenario, I think the engineers I worked with copied and pasted a decent few chunks out of my Swift UI prototype into the real app because the whole purpose was to like tweak these values to perfection so that the effect worked. In a lot of other cases, the code I write is a total mess. Like the engineers might glance at it when they are thinking through what they're building and like what edge cases I covered and how I handled them, but almost never is it specifically written to like be able to be put right into production. And I think that's a pretty separate skill set. And I think like not worrying about that lets me move much faster in coding. I am not a fantastic engineer by any means, and I probably would struggle greatly to write production code for a lot of these systems if I'm even capable of doing it right now. But I can put a million state variables in a file and say, when you change this, this one flips, and when you change that, that one changes, and hook up a prototype like that much faster than if I actually had to make it legible code.
For someone that doesn't have as much of a coding background, what are some of the ways that this kind of sticks and stones prototype that you're creating is significantly simpler than something that would make it to production?
A little bit tricky to answer because I am not great at knowing like what is required for production code. But what I would say is you can kind of just make a mess because the code you're writing is basically a means to an end for the artifact that is the prototype that you're going to be using. So it really doesn't matter what it looks like behind the scenes if it works the way you intended it to, because that's what you're using to communicate with folks. Now, that's not always the case, like I touched on the Linear onboarding thing, but if you don't have a programming background and you start learning little bits and pieces, the data you use in it can just be pulled from an array. It can be hard coded if you really want. If you only need to change one number when you update something in the prototype, you can make only that a variable where everything else is probably in a production environment is likely to be pulling from an API and kind of built more modularly and reusable components and things like that. So that's all stuff you don't have to worry about if you're just building it for the end goal being a single prototype.
I think for web, a lot of times where designers really, really sweat the details to make something feel amazing is in the hover state. And obviously that does not exist in mobile. So what are some of the areas where you might find yourself really sweating the details in the name of delight?
I constantly find myself wishing like there's some developed way to hover your finger over something and like your iPhone to detect it. Maybe it'll come someday, but I think one of the areas is kind of interactions and gestures and things that are based in real physics or close to real physics. So for example, if you swipe a modal pop-up, you swipe it away, that it kind of gradually responds to like the velocity of your swipe, some simulated gravity. And if you swipe it up and to the right, it doesn't just disappear from the view. It gradually moves up and to the right, slows down, and then maybe returns back to the center of the view where it disappears. I think doing things like that is one of those moments where you use it and you don't even realize that animation existed, because that's what you expected to happen, right? If you swipe a piece of paper on your desk, it's going to move the direction of your swipe. So I think that's one of the areas that like really adds that level of kind of invisible polish.
Anything else that we should be talking about or questions I should be asking in terms of like how you have grown as a mobile designer or someone who is like investing in this skill set of interaction design?
I think one of the big skills that is really valuable and has really influenced my career a lot is kind of this skill of more broadly called storytelling. And this is something that I really picked up and learned a lot. While I was working at GitHub, I worked with Brian Lovin, who I think was a guest on your podcast before. And he was really fantastic at this. And I learned a lot working alongside him on the GitHub mobile app, in that your job as a designer may be to like solve these problems and build these user experiences that like let someone get a job done. But the second part of your job is convincing the team of people you're working with that this is the right thing to build in this way at this time. I think you can do a lot of great work and none of it may ship if you don't have that second part of the skill set. So that's where learning to really clearly define the problem you're working on, how your solution addresses it, what the users are, that, like who they are that might be using it and when they're doing that. What I talked about earlier with mobile design might be more focused on like very quick interactions used in 1 to 2 minutes and then the phone's put away. And that's kind of like a very valuable skill for working with teams of all sizes and kind of what led me into this road of interaction design and developing more higher fidelity prototypes, because I realized how valuable having that prototype along with that story about the context of your work is. You know, you can set up the context and explain the problem you're solving and then show the prototype and say like, here's the proposed solution. This is what you would have if you're on board to build this in a month or so.
Is there anything that you're doing to make sure that you get the level of feedback that you need? Because I do think when you're communicating in static mocks, as you kind of alluded to earlier a little bit, like there is more of a burden on storytelling. Like you really have to use words to convey what is happening and the intent. Whereas like if it's a functional prototype, you can kind of just hand it over. But like, how do you think about the right questions to ask, or even when you're sending out this test flight, like, can you go a little bit deeper into what you're doing to make sure that you are sourcing the right inputs from the rest of the team to know where to take this thing?
Something I still struggle with a lot of the time is sharing some work I've done. Maybe you like explicitly say in the beginning, I'm looking for feedback on points 1, 2, and 3. You present the work and you get feedback on 1, 2, and 3, but like maybe the conversation's derailed by feedback on point 4. I haven't found a perfect solution. You know, like you try and educate your audience as to what feedback you're looking for as well as you can, but inevitably more feedback will come in. And I think you have to look at that as a good thing. You know, any feedback is feedback that I would like to be hearing, because that's something that can make the work I'm doing better. I think there's this other angle too, where presenting something in a prototype, even if it's just a click-through prototype in Figma, something very lower fidelity and put together, can go a long way in terms of guiding that feedback, right? Like if you show a bunch of static frames in Figma, it's very easy for someone to start critiquing the visuals of something in the lower left corner when what you're focused on is somewhere else. But if you show this in a prototype and you start interacting with it, that really draws the attention and focuses in on that. And I've found at least that that will kind of hone the feedback more towards useful to like what you're trying to get feedback on, and at least secondarily leave room for feedback on everything else.
Can we talk a little bit about your journey learning Swift UI? And maybe you could even give us a little bit of context first. Like, what foundational knowledge did you have in code before really diving into this? Like, at what point in your career did you start to tinker and explore in that world? And then, yeah, maybe you could tell us about how you have went about learning these new skills, and specifically you know, I'm seeing all these really interesting prototypes that you're sharing in SwiftUI on Twitter. And I'd love to just hear about your journey getting to the point where you're able to create something like that.
There's a few different things that led me there. I'd say, like, when I was in college, part of my studies on human-computer interaction involved some kind of like baseline level knowledge of computer science classes. So I actually started learning Java and C++, stuff that I don't really have a use for today, but taught me about arrays and variables and like conditional statements and kind of that very foundational layer of coding. So I had that knowledge, and I had actually spent a good bit of time working in Origami, which is super powerful tool. You can do some incredible things in there. It's basically like a visual code tool in a lot of ways. And I turned to that because I wanted this like very high ceiling of what's possible to create in a prototyping tool, so that I never felt like if I was trying to communicate an interaction and I had to preface it with like, this Figma transition is a little janky, it'll be better in production, that felt kind of like a failure of like designing that interaction well to me. You know, I wanted to like be in an environment where I could just do that. And Origami let me do that. But this is more a personal thing. I think with that foundational knowledge of basic programming principles, I would always hit these little corners of Origami where the way Origami wanted me to do it and the way that made sense in my brain like didn't quite align. So I was kind of like fighting the tool a little bit, and it got me far enough. But I, you know, SwiftUI came along and I had learned some React just to build my own website before that. And they're pretty similar in a lot of ways. And it got to the point where I was spending enough time like frustrated trying to hook up the right nodes in Origami to get my result. And I kept thinking like, I know how to use an array in code better than a loop in Origami. So I turned to SwiftUI and just started experimenting. You know, like a lot of my learning, whether it's icon design or 3D work or coding, just comes from pursuing personal projects and like really hitting the wall of my knowledge and then learning just enough to unblock myself until I hit the next wall can be kind of a frustrating process. But if you persist, you can learn a lot by doing that. And part of it was also like being inspired by seeing all of this cool work that other designers were posting online that was done in SwiftUI, and realizing the ceiling for what you can do in code, even Origami, is just entirely endless. You know, if you can imagine it, you can, they give you a lot of tools to make it very easy to like get most of the way there. So I started just with some very small personal projects. I like to just like start messing around. I think SwiftUI makes it easy to kind of take a static mockup in Figma and recreate it. Just the visuals, at least, you know, like that's a great way to start learning. Both things like Flexbox, if you're using web technologies, or SwiftUI's like HStack and VStack and ZStack, very closely mirrors Figma's auto layout. So if you're familiar with that, it's really easy to like jump in there, start getting some visuals on a screen. And it's really rewarding, even if it's something totally static, that you can plug your phone in and hit build and run in Xcode and have what you created visible in an app on your phone. I find that very rewarding. So that kind of just leads to a cycle where like I would kind of come up with progressively harder to code ideas for just like fun little prototypes I could experiment with in some free time and work on coding them. And again, when I'd hit a wall, I'd go on Stack Overflow, and very more recently, ChatGPT is like my best friend for learning more coding. Great time to start coding and unblock myself and then continue on to the next thing and go from there. And then when I felt comfortable enough and fast enough, I start applying it to my day-to-day work. And that's like, the more you're doing it, the more you're learning and the more confident you're getting with it. And it kind of all snowballs from there.
Let's say someone's listening to you. Their current ceiling of fidelity is a Figma prototype. They're inspired by what you're saying. How should they think about which route to go down? Should they download Origami or should they download Xcode?
It's a good question. I don't think you can make a wrong choice. I think when you open up each tool, and you can use them interchangeably, I mean, they're very similar in a lot of ways. I personally just like writing code. It feels a little bit more, the code I write is theoretically going to be around forever. You know, SwiftUI might change, the frameworks might change. It might not run super well in the future, but Origami files are very like confined to, you can run this in Origami and that's about it. You can't really go wrong. I just, looking at the landscape, I thought that I felt more confident in my ability to learn more and more and apply that to broader things through code. You know, like maybe one day I want to build my own iOS app, and having this base of prototyping through Xcode and Swift is getting me farther towards that goal than doing it all in origami. That's one of the factors that comes in, but really, like, just start small and start chipping away at it and ask questions when you get stuck, and you'll learn a lot very fast, and it'll be very rewarding in either tool you choose.
Speaking of asking questions, what have you learned about interacting with ChatGPT that's helping you get unblocked with SwiftUI?
That's a good question. I don't like the idea of turning to ChatGPT and saying, I need an app that does this. And then it gives me code that I don't understand, and pasting it into Xcode and telling it what the errors are and letting it debug it itself, because I don't really learn a lot from that. So what I try and do is, like, do as much as I can myself, if only for, like, if I'm writing a bunch of just visual, like, layout code, not very tough to understand, kind of like the base level stuff. If I ask ChatGPT to give me that boilerplate, it might be, like, written with slightly different styling that I don't like to use, and, like, I'm just going to go back and correct it. So I try and do a lot of it myself. And when I get stuck on something, I try and really isolate the problem and say, like, teach me about how to solve this. Don't just solve it for me. I think that's where you learn the most. So I would encourage folks to, if you know nothing about React and you're trying to build your first website, ask ChatGPT for the basics of React, or, like, read the React docs and kind of start there. Start coding it yourself. When you get stuck and you want to do something that you don't know how to do, ask it how you do that, rather than, like, taking all of your code and pasting it and saying, build that for me. I think you'll learn a lot more, and it'll be much more valuable for you, like, as you keep going, rather than always needing this tool to give you the answer and you're relying on it entirely.
I mean, so you're actually, like, typing in language like that, like, teach me how to think about X, or teach me how to do X.
Yeah. A lot of the time I'll say, like, I want this to happen. How would I do that? And then it'll say, like, here's how you do it. And I don't give it all of my code, so it kind of generalizes a lot of it, which I find very helpful. And then I'll say, like, okay, like, I won't literally type okay, but there'll be a piece of syntax it uses that I don't quite understand. And I'll say, can you explain why this symbol is in the code here, and, like, what that means? You know, SwiftUI has this thing called trailing closure syntax, which I still don't really understand it. And you can write SwiftUI without using it, and for whatever reason, a lot of people love using it. It's just, it makes your code shorter to read, I guess, but I find it hampers my understanding. So I'm like, it uses a piece of trailing closure syntax. I'm like, okay, wait, explain, like, word by word in these three lines, what each word is doing and why you used it. And then I'll kind of slowly get a better understanding.
Is there a aha moment, or just, like, some kind of thing that you've accomplished in SwiftUI that had you really excited recently that you could share?
There's this prototype I built. It was a bunch of months ago now. I think it was, like, back in January-ish, but it's posted on my website and Twitter, where I tried to make a watchOS app grid interaction kind of on your iPhone. So kind of that hexagonal, like, honeycomb shape of app icons, rather than our 4x4 grid or whatever it is on iOS. And it's one of those moments. This is why I love code versus something like a Figma prototype or a other prototyping tools, are kind of like keyframe animation type stuff, because I wanted to be able to pinch on the grid and see between, like, 1 and 100 app icons as you kind of zoomed out, right? What I did with the help of some ChatGPT was build an initial app icon and then say, okay, like, you get your for loop and you say, for 0 to 100 app icons, I want you to place them each. And every time you place one, offset it by this amount and this amount if it's in this position, and two different amounts if it's in this position. And suddenly you, like, hit the right incantation of your for loop and your entire grid just appears and it just works. And those are those moments where I'm like, I got it. I did it. This is my goal. It might be silly and have no purpose at the end of the day, but part of the fun was learning more SwiftUI, was experimenting with this idea. Maybe a very small piece of that makes it into some of my mobile design work in the future. Maybe it doesn't, but, like, that's kind of those fun little aha moments I love in coding as a designer that bring me a lot of joy and motivate me to keep going.
Can you help someone, again, who's listening, who, like, doesn't have this technical background, but they're inspired? What are some of the pieces of foundational knowledge that you think are most important that they should actively seek an understanding of in order to be able to build these more interesting experiments on top of it?
Maybe it's helpful because, like, I still probably don't know a lot of coding, just enough to make some prototypes. But I'd say, like, a good foundational base, and if you disagree with this, don't email me, but it's kind of like knowing your basic data storage, like arrays will be super helpful. If statements saying like, if X do Y, if Y do Z type of thing. And then for loops are kind of like, or loops in general, just continuously run this code until I say so. I think that's, I don't have this definition offhand, but that might be like the collection of things you need for something to be Turing complete, which means like you can theoretically accomplish anything with the coding language. So just having a really basic understanding of that, and variables is probably the other one there, will give you this foundation where like you can write a bunch of really just awful code that some experienced engineer would never ship to production, but will get you off to the races and like get you learning and continuing to work. So I'd say start there with some foundations. They're in like every programming language, so it doesn't really matter what you choose, and it's easy to apply them across languages too.
I like your perspective. Maybe an engineer would poke holes on the things that maybe you're missing or something like that, but like you're making it feel very attainable, and I've like seen the things that you've been able to build, and it's like, okay, well, that doesn't sound that bad, you know?
That's one of these cool things with like teaching somebody something, is often I find the best teachers are people who struggled with it initially themselves, because they can put themselves in the shoes of someone who is struggling to learn thing X, Y, or Z and relate to that and think like, here's how I unblock myself here. Where when you have someone trying to teach you something where the subject just came very naturally to them, it might be more of a like, why do you not understand this? Like, I don't know other ways to explain this that'll help your understanding. So hopefully my struggling through learning code can help others struggle a little bit less on their journey.
I mean, you're totally right. It's like, in some ways, if you are interested in learning SwiftUI, the last person you want to learn from is the expert in SwiftUI. Like the more interesting person to learn from is like, who's like maybe one or two rungs on this ladder ahead of me, because they deeply empathize with the struggles that I'm going through. And they remember how certain things trip me up, or how challenging like wrapping around like this mental model was.
You can learn some bad habits along the way, but like you can always iron those out and kind of progress up to learning from the expert themselves eventually.
Well, Gavin, thank you so much for coming on and sharing about your journey. I know I personally am inspired by all the things that you're sharing and creating. And, you know, it's quite obvious that you're someone that enjoys learning and kind of pushing on that ceiling of what you're capable of creating. So thank you for coming on today, but also just continuing to put yourself out there and inspiring us.
Great. Yeah. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. I've loved listening to other episodes of your podcast. So I hope this one helps someone out there, or inspires them, or makes them curious about something.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, if you want to go even deeper, each week I send an email out to over 10,000 designers with bonus resources and key takeaways from these conversations. So head to dive.club/email to sign up. Okay, I'll see you next week.